This is Jane Latour on December 26, 2004, interviewing Margarita Suarez. So Margarita, tell me about your beginnings, where you were born and when. And
well, I was born in Manila, Philippines. That's where my family is from. But at an early age, at 6 months old, we moved to Rochester, New York.
Oh.
And so I spent probably the first half of my time at home living up in the upstate region. And then when I was about 11, I think we moved to northern Florida, Jacksonville, Florida, where I finished high school and got ready for college. And I actually came to college at Columbia University. I attended Columbia College and graduated in 1989.
Okay, now first tell me what year you were born.
I was born in 1967.
Okay.
So I'm 37 years old.
Mm-hmm. And what was your major at Columbia?
At Columbia, I studied computer science. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about it was that I was attending the liberal arts college, so I had fewer engineering related electives and more humanities related electives, but the major was computer science.
Now, you know, my knowledge of this is related to experience I had at Hewlett-Packard. I worked for them in 1967.
Wow.
And the computer was the computer. There was a huge mainframe, and it was in one room, and everything had to be air-conditioned for the computer. But I was working on making circuit boards.
Oh, nice.
So tell me about the state of, by the time you got to college.
Well, by the time I got to college, I guess in high school was when the Macintosh personal computer had come out, the original Lisa and Mac 128K. Mm-hmm. And, of course, PCs were starting to catch on. Microsoft was just getting started. That was in the early 80s, I guess. And so by the time I got to college, I'd had a couple of years of experience actually having a computer in the house. I did my high school term papers on the computer and probably mm-hmm. was the only person in my class not to use a typewriter.
Wow.
And then by the time I arrived at college, there were mainframes that we had. We actually had email, I think. The origins of email and the internet are rooted in the Department of Defense and their funding to universities for research.
Mm-hmm.
So being at a large research university, I had access to internet resources that only recently have become available to everybody else. When I first arrived, it was a mainframe, although the mainframe was probably about half as big as the one you were
mm-hmm.
working with. It wasn't an air-conditioned room. But by the time I finished college, I started working at the university for the computing department,
mm-hmm.
the academic computing department.
Now, let's back up a little, a couple of things. First, in terms of your parents, what did your parents do for occupations?
My parents were professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So my father was an architect and my mom is a chemist. And my dad's pretty much retired right now, but he still
mm-hmm.
does projects for churches and residences. But when we were in Rochester, he worked for large firms that I think built corporate buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And when we moved to Rochester, my mother was working at a hospital, I believe, for a while, and that doing research on cancer or liver disease. And then she worked for Eastman Kodak for a number of years, doing research on polymers.
Mm-hmm. Now, when did you, obviously you're good at math, right?
I can manage, yes.
Uh-huh. I just assume that that's a prerequisite for work with computers.
It is, to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had to take calculus, and there is some conversion of number systems, like from decimal to binary. But really, I guess it's not so much the numbers math that's important, but the logical math
okay.
that's important. Boolean logic, if then,
mm-hmm.
else, and control structure, flow structures, and that kind of thing. It's a very logical field.
So now, when you in high school, did you take many classes where did you notice any gender differences in the classroom in terms of your interests and your aptitudes?
Well, I attended a Catholic school for my entire time,
mm-hmm.
and by the time I got to high school, there were honors track classes, that, if I think about it, my closest friends in those classes, I had more female friends than male friends. But I'm trying to think, if I were to count the kids in the class, I think in the physics class there probably were more boys than there were girls. But the valedictorian and salutatorian of my high school were both women, and they were both very strong in science and math. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now you started to work for the academic computing program at Columbia?
I worked for the academic computing program, and when I first started working with them, I was a student consultant. I would sit in a computer lab where there were terminals accessing the mainframe, not personal computers, but terminals, mm-hmm. and we would assist the students who were doing their homework. Now, at that time, in 1985, or I guess it was the fall of 85, spring of 86 when I started, the users of the computers were mostly social scientists or social mm-hmm. social science students, you know, psychologists and I don't know what else.
Trying to do data
regressions.
Survey and
yes, they were running statistical analysis uh-huh. packages. There were probably like civil engineers trying to run Fortran programs and other scientific applications. And it wasn't until, let's see, that was when I was an undergraduate, and then just as I was about to graduate, I landed a full-time job as a systems programmer. And so from the year 1989, I think I quit in 2000, so mm-hmm. 11-year period of time, I saw the computers move from these pretty large, you know, at least refrigerator-sized yeah. mainframes to pizza box-sized supercomputers, or very fast computers mm-hmm. that could handle hundreds and hundreds of users. And somewhere in the middle of there, people started to get email who weren't just the computer science mm-hmm. students and the social science students. And then probably a couple of years after that, people's grandmothers and mothers were having email. And now, you know, I think it was around 1993 that I first was introduced to a web browser, an mm-hmm. internet browser. And now, 10 years later, 11 years later, you can see how many people use the web browser every day.
Mm-hmm. When you were an undergraduate, what was the gender breakdown in terms of your studying computers?
In studying computers, well, of course, in the liberal arts courses, it was pretty much 50-50. Mm-hmm. I think the school was pretty much 50-50, maybe 51 women, 49 men. But in the computer science classes, and even in the math and science classes, I had to take chemistry and calculus. I'd say in chemistry and calculus, it was probably 30 or 40% women and the rest men. And in the computer science classes, often there would be a lecture of 60 people and three of them would be women, or maybe mm-hmm. four. So that was kind of interesting, because in any class you sort of have a demographic, the demographic of the students is that you have the ones who are, you know, superstars, then you have mm-hmm. the ones who are average students, then you have the ones who are always struggling to keep along. And I found that sometimes among those three or four or six women, more of them tended to be the strugglers. So that was kind of an interesting mm-hmm. breakdown. You know, at one point, I actually remember consciously realizing that I didn't have to be a struggler. And I mean, that's kind of a story in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I was a project partner with a Russian immigrant guy, mm-hmm. and he had just moved to the States maybe 10 years before I met him, or 8 years before I met him. And he just had this attitude of, let's get the highest grade. And I'd never had that attitude. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard of that attitude before, and we did it. And that kind of taught me that the guys who are in class talking as if they know that what they're talking about, oftentimes they don't know what they're talking about, whereas mm-hmm. a woman who doesn't know what she's talking about will just probably be quiet or ask stupid questions mm-hmm. or ask the same question but in a less confident tone. And so I kind of came up with my own survival techniques and also a different attitude towards school. School wasn't something that you just survived through. It was something that you really conquered and got what you needed out of and excelled at.
So when you started in the academic computing, well, the programming job, now that's the technical part
right.
of computer world. And how was that for you? What did you like about it?
Well, I worked in a small group, and the group was four people, two men and two women. Mm-hmm. So even though in the field of systems programming, probably I don't know, it's probably getting to be more than 25% now, but, you know, it's not as small a percent as women in construction, but it's not half either. But in my first job environment, it was half. Half of us were women. Mm. And we were all, I mean, I was the junior one, but pretty much we had equal responsibilities. And so that was a very nurturing environment, and it was a great job. I mean, just the flexibility, the culture of the workplace was very relaxed in terms of dress code and what time mm-hmm. you had to show up and how long a lunch you could have. Mm-hmm. Also, but we also had to carry pagers and be woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning and attend to things when most people would probably be off work.
Mm-hmm. And what about the challenge of the job itself? Are you learning new things? And
yeah, I had to learn everything I knew, and in fact, it was almost like an apprenticeship, except it wasn't formal. Mm-hmm. It was on-the-job training, I guess. Uh-huh. You're basically thrown into some situations, and you're working with someone who's more experienced than you, and you pick up tips and tricks, and they instruct you, and you figure it out on your own a little bit. And so, you know, that's what I like to... That's one thing that I learned about, at least my experience in going into computing, because there are different kinds of people who are attracted to jobs involving technology, and or different kinds of skills that you can employ. And one technique is to attend an academy and get a certificate in a certain type of technology, and then any company has to honor that you know that technology when you're holding that certificate. Mm-hmm. But I think what is
isn't there a danger because technology is changing so rapidly?
Yeah, that's what I think. I mean, I think it's, and not everybody has these skills or is able mm-hmm. to develop these skills, but I think if one is able to develop these skills, it's more important than the certificate is to have the ability to look at anything new and figure out, mm-hmm. Based on what I know about the way things are supposed to work, what can I figure out about this? Not using any manuals, not using any certificate program, but approaching everything as if it's brand new and different. And
and this is where the logic comes in.
It's a lot of logic. It's a lot of synthesis of information. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know, I think I have a knack. I have a knack for that maybe not everybody has. And I think the people who are the most successful and go the farthest in technological fields are able to synthesize a lot of information and, deduce things from other things. It's not a matter of memorizing, a textbook mm-hmm. and repeating it on a certification exam. So that's kind of the thing that I've been thinking about, too, in terms of the sort of Department of Labor has a big push to move people towards technology, technological jobs. But I think the danger is if we don't put an emphasis on education when they're a child mm-hmm. and help them to develop those analytical skills, the people who are able to enter technology by repeating things by rote aren't going to go very far. They're going to make $10 an hour, and they're going to be stuck there. And they're going to be limited to that technology, and when that technology is over, they're going to, it's a dead-end job, so mm-hmm. you might as well work at Walmart or something, mm-hmm. in my opinion. I think there are probably paths that I don't know about, pathways, to get farther, or maybe the ones who are gonna shine will shine out of that situation and move themselves up. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really sure. With the rate that technology changes, it kind of makes it difficult to design, for example, a technology apprenticeship. I think a lot of the skills that you're gonna have to teach aren't about specific technologies, but about how to learn about technologies.
Mm-hmm. Did you start a master's when you were at Columbia?
Yeah, well, you're asking what did I like a lot about my job mm-hmm. at Columbia, and besides yeah. the very liberal culture, it was, we also got a lot of vacation days, access to all mm-hmm. the university resources, mm-hmm. and tuition exemption. So right after I graduated from my undergrad, I think it was the following fall even, I entered the master's program.
Master's in
computer science, mm-hmm. and this was through the engineering school this time.
Okay.
So there were a couple of prerequisites that I hadn't taken as an undergraduate since I had attended the liberal arts college.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. So I had to take a probability and statistics class. I might have had to take more math, I'm not sure. And I just
how
took...
How did you do in those classes? Did you find you had an aptitude, you liked it?
I did have an aptitude, and I also had perspective. I was older, and I was choosing to do this. I wasn't feeling like, okay, everybody goes to college, and I just have to be here and mm-hmm. get by. And I also was only taking one or two classes at a time, but I was working full-time.
Right.
But in a way, even though I had to work all day, I only had to focus on one set of homework and one set of exams. You know,
yeah.
I had an advantage, I think, over the younger students who were a little more, like, the ones who were completing their master's in 2 or 3 years probably were a lot more stressed out than I was doing it in 5.
Mm-hmm. And once again, you were in the School of Engineering now, so did you notice how did the gender thing break out?
I think there were even fewer women in the master's program in the School of Engineering. Very, very few. I think maybe half as many as there had been as I was an undergrad. And I think a lot of the women probably also didn't stick with the program. Mm-hmm. I mean, probably men dropped out too, but mm-hmm. they kept their critical mass.
I was reading that about 15% nationally of women getting PhDs in engineering and technology are female. That's kind of a low figure.
It is pretty low. Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting because, the chairman of the chairperson of the computer science department is a woman, mm-hmm. and she was one of my professors mm-hmm. back when I was an undergrad. There were a few prominent professors who were women, but the bulk of them, of course, were male, and the bulk of the students were male.
So you went from that program. It took you 5 years, and you were at Columbia the whole time.
I was.
And then what did you have a job, a career change when you finished that?
Well, I finished the master's program in 94, I believe. And then I was still working at the same job. I was moving up in the ranks. Mm-hmm. At one point, I was, at the time that I left, I was lead of my group. So I was pretty, I had, when I started the group, I had taken the position of the boss that I had when I started. So mm-hmm. basically, they have it's a professional job. It's a, what they call an officer position, as opposed to a support staff position. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of, classism built into the structure there. But mm-hmm. You start out as a beginner, and then you move up to, from C to B to A, and then at one point you can be promoted to lead, and that's what I was when I left. But all along, I continued to take classes. Even after my master's was over, mm-hmm. I took some Spanish classes. I took an art class or two. And at some point, I decided to enter the Women's Studies program, and I got a second bachelor's through tuition exemption as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I stayed all through that. I finished that in the end of 1999. And I guess the big thing that happened to me was that in 1998, Hurricane Mitch went through Central America.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long story. In 1990s, I was doing some traveling too. That's
okay.
what I was doing
mm-hmm.
along the way, because there was a very generous vacation package. So I had traveled around the world a bit, and one of the places I had visited was Nicaragua, and I had visited a women's construction collective there. So that was in 1997, just as a tourist,
mm-hmm.
and I actually worked with them a little bit for about a week.
Did you find out the history of that collective?
Yes. In fact, it's a very interesting history because, fast forwarding to just a few years ago when I was working at Non-Traditional Employment for Women, I started encountering, or even before I worked for them, just right before, this was in probably 1999, 2000,
mm-hmm.
I started volunteering my time to help this town that I had visited as a tourist rebuild from the hurricane, and in particular, I was helping a women's studies, a women's construction
mm-hmm.
collective.
Mm-hmm. And what was the town?
The town was named Condega, Nicaragua.
Mm-hmm.
And in the process of fundraising for this trip to Condega, I met Rebecca Lurie, Ellie Spicer. Actually, I didn't meet Ellie until a couple years later, but Rebecca Lurie was involved in organizing similar building brigades for women back in 1986, 87, I believe, to the same town. And in fact, the school that they built with the women in Nicaragua is still there. And the women who had been involved in building that school decided to form a collective, which is the collective that I visited and then that I helped out. So along the way, I've met a lot of women who have been to this town, a lot of tradeswomen who have been to this town. I think Beth Yone was even involved. She's in Oakland, mm-hmm. California. And Evan Ruderman had been involved in organizing mm-hmm. that.
And I think Bruni Hernandez.
Oh, I didn't know that Bruni was. I don't. Oh, is that Melinda Hernandez? Is that Bruni?
No.
No, it's a different Hernandez. I don't think I've met
She's
Bruni.
A nurse now, but she was an electrician. One of the first women electricians.
Okay, I don't think I've ever met her.
Yeah, no, she doesn't live here anymore.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But it's just interesting, it has a real New York connection.
Yeah, there's a big New York connection because those brigades back in the late 80s were organized out of New York and Boston. I think there were women from London who went, and I think there were some women from California mm-hmm. who went. But
so their experience of actually working on, well, you were doing the fundraising, and then you...
Well, I was doing the fundraising, and... I guess I should mention that, one of the projects that I had done, the extracurricular project that I had done while I was at Columbia, using my vacation time, was to help a pottery school build a wood-fired kiln mm-hmm. in the Catskills. So there was a lot of commuting on long weekends in the summer, over the summer, and there was pouring concrete, there was, you know, wood frame, pole barn, I guess is what you call it. It's a roof on poles, construction of that, and also laying the blocks for the kiln itself, mm-hmm. which included an arch that we had to make by laying the bricks on a form and pulling the form out after the bricks were there and leaving the arch standing up. So there was, I've always had an interest in building things, mm-hmm. you know, and so this is just kind of all tying together because when I was young, my dad, who's an architect, he used to have a carpentry shop in the garage, and I remember at the age of 5 or 6 being in there with him while he was building something, and he would, you know, let me finish pounding the nail in or finish mm-hmm. screwing the screw in, or I would hold the wood together while he drove the nail and that kind of thing. I would hand him tools, and that just seemed really normal, and I mm-hmm. always was comfortable with that, I think because of that experience. And so, you know, there were some building projects along the way. There was the big kiln building project. I built pieces of furniture for friends for their kitchen and that kind of thing. And then, so by the time that the hurricane happened and there was a chance to help this collective out, mm-hmm. well, I should also mention that when I was visiting the collective as a tourist, I actually spent 2 or 3 days working with them. They taught me how to lay blocks, how to tie the iron reinforcement together. I guess you call it metal lathing here in New York. I learned how to pour the concrete, you know, in just 3 days. They let me try all that stuff and help mm-hmm. them out with all that stuff. And so I actually had a pretty selfish reason for getting involved with their fundraising project because I wanted to be one of the women to go on the building brigade. Mm-hmm. And actually, they would have preferred having professionally skilled mm-hmm. tradeswomen because it would just be a little bit less of a...
Speed things up.
Yeah, it would speed things up. On the other hand, they welcomed anyone who wanted to help because there's always a powerful exchange when women are helping each other from different countries with different languages. There's something that each side gets from the other, and so they knew about that because that was happening all through the 80s. Mm-hmm. I'm sure with all the solidarity workers coming through. But that brigade, we raised funds for it, and we went down in February 1999, and there were 6 of us. Only one of us was a professional builder from mm-hmm. Wales, and there were probably 3 or 4 women from New York and one from Boston. And one from Boston. And we were there for a month, some stayed for 2, and we started the first house of that project, and eventually there were 30 houses built. So, you know, that was really great mm-hmm. to be the inaugural brigade to start it all off.
So this, did this lead to your egress from Columbia and moving over to New?
Well, it most certainly led to my egress from Columbia. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend not to make long-term plans at all. Maybe I'll plan a year or 2 in mm-hmm. advance, but I kind of have been taking life as it comes, and that's been working for me. So at the time, I think the main thing that was happening in my head was I was realizing that, you know, I'd had this incredible experience of going to Nicaragua, helping out these people who lost their entire house, and working with these women who had third grade educations but were learning a trade to mm-hmm. make a living, and building something that someone could live in, you know, actually making something out of nothing. And also just being around, you know, a different way of life, mm-hmm. a different tempo, different values, you know, different levels of wealth or poverty. And after going to Nicaragua a couple of times, scraping together vacation days and leaves of absence, and feeling guilty all the time because I was the lead of the group, and so it was hard for me to take off for indefinite periods of time. The main conclusion that I arrived at was that there are many types of crises in the world. There's losing your email, and there's losing your house. Mm-hmm. And I found it harder and harder to reconcile the amount of stress and pressure that I was putting upon myself, or people were putting upon me, to get that email back up mm-hmm. now at 4 a.m. when I had just returned from helping someone get their house back up. Right. So it was a really hard decision to make. It took me about a year to come to the conclusion that I really could make the decision. Part of it was fear of change, I'm mm-hmm. sure, and just insecurity of what, you know, the unknown. But part of it was also that I had a mint position. I was making a lot of money, you know, for a nonprofit, you know, without the pressures of being on Wall Street or somewhere mm-hmm. where I could make more money. And a lot of education, a lot of smart people everywhere, and lectures to attend, and movies, mm-hmm. movie screenings, and classes to take, and access to the gym and the library. And
22 libraries.
And that was a thing that I discovered when I was doing my my second undergraduate degree, because I actually chose to do that degree, that whenever I needed a resource from the library, it was at the Columbia Library. I think I went to interlibrary loan 3 times mm-hmm. or 4 times, mm-hmm. but for the most part, if I was looking around in the indexes for what kind of article or book mm-hmm. I would want to see, they had it. And I was like, wow, this is really great to be here and have mm-hmm. access to this. So so really the decision was only to leave Columbia and go to Nicaragua for an indefinite amount mm-hmm. of time, and then see what happened. So the plan included subletting my apartment for a number of months to save money on rent, saving up money, getting rid of all my worldly possessions, you know, storing them with this friend, mm-hmm. giving them to that friend, selling them on eBay, whatever. And I ended up moving down here to Jane Street and into a small room. All my possessions pretty much fit in that room. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty different, you know, change of lifestyle from having a 2-bedroom apartment pretty much all to myself. Mm-hmm. But it was also pretty freeing to realize that I didn't need all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't end up moving to Nicaragua for an indefinite period of time. I ended up deciding to go there for 3 months. And I went there, I quit my Columbia job in June 2000. I went there from July through October 2000. And when I came back, of course, my whole life was new, and I had no trappings of, no obligations really. And the reality of it is that I'm kind of a workaholic. Mm-hmm. So I started getting a little depressed and not knowing really what to do with my days, because I didn't have a job to show up to, and I didn't mm-hmm. really have a project. So I started looking around around November, I guess it was about a month after I got back, for a project. And at the end of the month, I was calling Habitat for Humanity. I was looking around. I called New, and whom I had contacted when I was doing my fundraising for and searching for brigadistas for my brigades back in February 2000. I hadn't been in touch with them at all, but I just called up and I said, "Hey, I have some spare time. I'd like to volunteer." And they said, "Sure, send us your resume." So I was about to get my resume ready, mm-hmm. and I was looking on idealist.org, and I found out that New actually had a paid position that was open 3 days a week, coordinating the federal WANTU grant, mm-hmm. and WANTU stands for Women in Apprenticeships and Non-Traditional Occupations. And I knew nothing about labor unions, mm-hmm. really. I mean, definitely not about construction unions in New York City. I didn't even really, hadn't really even focused on labor so much, mm-hmm. except for, you know, reading a little bit of Marx and Engels in college. And so it was almost, I almost felt that I wasn't qualified for that job, but it did really interest me, so I ended up interviewing for it, and I ended up landing it. So that started the career change, mm-hmm. but I can't say that I set out to do that when I left Columbia, mm-hmm. although I was open to seeing where it was going to take me.
Mm-hmm. So as the coordinator of the Wanto Grant, what did you have to do? What were your job responsibilities?
Well, at first it was pretty difficult because there was a large learning curve, but
so you were describing the Wanto job on paper as opposed
yeah.
to the reality.
Well, to implement the grant as written, which had to do with reaching out to a number of employers and unions and providing some supportive services to tradeswomen. And it also encompassed a little bit of, I guess, enhancing the training programs. And then there were, like, I'm sure what they were mostly worried about was getting the reports in on time, mm-hmm. because the agency was doing the work, really. The work was going to go on no matter what, but because it was federal funding, there were quarterly reports due, mm-hmm. and a final report at the end of the year.
So which parts of all those things, I mean, everything, it's so interesting because everything is connected to everything else with the world of tradeswomen.
Yeah.
And everything has to be done.
Yeah.
Everything has to be addressed. So what were the things that you brought to that job and that you started doing that to try
right.
to?
Well, I think probably the part that I enjoyed most about the job was reaching out to the tradeswomen and supporting them.
Mm-hmm.
Because I guess maybe it's because they are the willing party in the whole equation.
Right.
You know, I think it's really important to educate and promote and bring the message of you know, supporting women in trades to the employers and the unions. But until you can get that contact, that in, who's the willing party, it's an uphill struggle because basically the grant paid for us to provide technical assistance to these entities. And only until recently have these entities wanted the technical assistance. It became chic or, you know, I guess for legal reasons, maybe economic reasons, they want to cover themselves, or maybe they really have a goodwill reason for wanting to get technical assistance. But at the time when I started, and given that I had no contacts and no ins, I had to develop all these relationships, it was really difficult to cold call, you know, the owner of a company and mm-hmm. say, wouldn't you like help fixing your problem? Because they didn't think that they had a problem,
right.
and they'd rather just not talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely helping the women and encouraging them and supporting them was the most worthwhile part, especially in the very beginning.
So in terms of the biggest challenges of that position, what were some of the real difficult, I mean, things that you see that needed to be done that hardly are difficult to move forward?
That's a hard question. I mean, it got easier toward the end to do that outreach to the employers because
mm-hmm.
a lot of them became more willing or even proactively sought out help with their recruiting. I still would think that 90% of the construction unions in New York City don't think they need help, but there are certain number of unions that did foster good relationships with
mm-hmm.
us and ask for help.
What unions?
Well, I know that there are good relationships now with the painters, the laborers, the carpenters, and there's always been a pretty good relationship with the electricians in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other trades have been historically more difficult, especially the more stereotyped the work is. You know, obviously not every man is going to succeed at being a bricklayer, and also not every woman will succeed at that, too. But a lot of times a trade will will close their door rather than open it and see who walks in. I think the most frustrating thing was lack of resources, because I was one person, and it wasn't even a full-time job.
Right.
And there were so many things that I could think that we could do, and materials that we could make, and meetings that we should have had, and you know, there wasn't enough time in a day for me to do everything all by myself. Mm-hmm. I think even in terms of reaching out to women, I mean, I enjoy my interactions with the women that we did have access to, but there's so many women out there who
need good jobs.
Need good jobs, and who would be good at this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the other thing, because I think one of the challenges that New has as an agency is that, you know, times are hard for everyone, especially nowadays. And even for the men who need a good job, and that's the only thing that they're really concentrating on at the moment, and worse for women, maybe they have childcare responsibilities or family care responsibilities. In a perfect world, if we had infinite resources, I think I would start with young girls, and that way they would have 10, 20 years to figure out whether this is right for them.
Right. Now, you did do some job training. You worked with Rebecca Lurie on the Consortium for Worker Education
Yes.
program. Tell me about that.
It's called Construction Skills 2000.
Uh-huh.
And it was funding from New York State, I believe, through a Built on Pride grant. And it had a number of facets. She could probably tell you a bit better than mm-hmm. I, but as I recall, there was some case management to make sure that those entering the trades would have the support that they needed and the tutoring that they needed, if necessary. And there was also a youth component, which involved getting kids from high school, from vocational programs, and bringing them to the trades. So, of course, vocational high schools in New York City, there was that report by the National Women's Law Center, I believe, that the report card that showed that 95% of the students in trades, high-paying trades tracks in those vocational schools were boys, and 99%, I believe, of those in the beautification tracks were girls. And if you compare the salaries of those mm-hmm. two kinds of jobs, you know, the girls are making a third of what the boys are potentially making. So as a worker as helping out in that program, I made some visits to high schools. I tried to go to classes where there would be girls, so mm-hmm. the business track sometimes would have girls. And I would we would go with a couple of tradeswomen and talk about what it was like for women to work in the trades.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think I worked there for about a year, one cycle and a half. And in the first cycle, I believe out of 60 students, there might have been 6 girls. So it's about 10%, which mm-hmm. is better than the ratio of the trades. But the boys tended to be coming from programs where they had a little more experience than the girls. The girls might have been coming from the business programs. And some of them succeeded, some of them dropped out. But it was pretty challenging. And it was my first real interaction with New York City high school kids, especially coming from vocational programs, mm-hmm. which unfortunately often tend to be the place where people shove the behavioral problem mm-hmm. kids and the learning disabled kids, as well as the kids who want to be there, I'm sure. But, you know, it was a rude awakening, the state of the New York City schools, to realize that some of the students couldn't read. You know, some of them, if you handed them a piece of graph paper, they couldn't draw a 10x10 square. You know, that was it was pretty hard for me to realize that. And there were a lot of behavioral problems,
mm-hmm.
some stealing, some fighting. But all in all, it was really great to have that experience. I taught a class with another teacher called Hands-on Technology, and we tried to
And you designed that class, right?
We designed that curriculum, yes. And we used actually a project that came from, I believe, came from West Point. But it was a bridge building project. So we got to look at the bridge that links Queens to Roosevelt Island and see how it was made. It's a truss mm-hmm. bridge. You know, most railroad bridges are truss bridges. Mm-hmm. And then we built a truss bridge out of manila file folder material that could withstand about 20 pounds of weight. And so a lot of the kids didn't really have the ability to envision what the outcome might be like, so it was hard to get some of them to do the project. But once the bridges were made, I think those who didn't do theirs were a little bit envious mm-hmm. that the others got to test their bridge, and everybody was really excited on the day that we tested the bridges and, you know, to mm-hmm. see whose bridge would take the most weight and that kind of thing.
And you see what can be done with the kids when there's effort and
If we'd had more time, yeah. definitely, or if we'd been able to split the classes by ability level or mm-hmm. whatever. I mean, this was just kind of, it seemed like a random conglomeration of kids. Some of them were able to, some of them had learning environment issues, I'm sure, mm-hmm. anyway, because they'd probably been having a hard time in school before they got to this situation. Mm-hmm. But all in all, it was a pretty neat opportunity because most of those kids got placed in apprenticeships, and I don't know how many were able mm-hmm. to stay.
And in any females?
Yeah, some females mm-hmm. were placed as well, mm-hmm. a handful.
Great. So speaking of that, I know that you were involved through TNT on this national effort to address principles of training for women and girls. And
you
want to speak a little about that?
Well, TNT started as a, I guess it's a group of tradeswomen's activists from around the country, many of whom were involved in national tradeswomen's organizing previously. I think 10 years before TNT had started, there was a group called National Tradeswomen's Network, which was started and then ended up getting dissolved there was a schism or it didn't stay together, funding issues. I mean, whenever you have a group of people trying to change a situation radically, there's going to be different ways that people envision that it can be done, mm-hmm. and I'm sure that probably even vision might have been one of the reasons why. And I think there were class issues. You know, it just didn't fly for some reason. So when TNT was being envisioned, that was with the context of this other failed group and also with 10 more years of seeing what's happened to women. So by the time TNT started, a lot of women had been working in the trades since 25 years of women in the trades. And I got involved in the strategic planning period as part of my job as WANTU coordinator. I was working closely with Evan Ruderman, and she had been involved in the organizing of this new group, and so she kind of hooked me in. And a year or two after I got involved, we actually were able to launch the organization. We'd come up with bylaws and officer structure, board structure, and the main purpose of TNT is to try to influence policy on the national level regarding women in trades and girls in trades and technology. And I guess the idea was that in many localities, we have tradeswomen's groups in Chicago and New York and in Portland, Maine, and San Francisco mm-hmm. and LA and Seattle, and, mm-hmm. Scattered around the country. And probably about 40 of them that we know about. And I'm sure there's a few more and more informal ones that we mm-hmm. don't know about. But everyone's working so hard at their local level, but then we have these national funding streams and national policies and legislation that affects everybody on the national level, and we needed a voice to advocate for tradeswomen on that level. So since the inception of TNT, we've gone to Capitol Hill a couple of times. We've visited with senators and congresspeople, and we had Hillary Clinton speaking at our congressional luncheon a couple of years ago. Was that last year? Last year? Mm-hmm. We're really getting a lot of visibility and really educating a lot of the lawmakers about what our issues are, working on different pieces of legislation like the Carl Perkins Vocational and Technical Education Act on WANTU, which it seems like that funding stream has gotten taken out of the budget, but maybe we can get it put back in, maybe even under a different department of the government. There's legislation in the Department of Transportation that would allow for job training of women and minorities.
Is that the ICE-T?
That's ICE-T, T21, mm-hmm. right? So all these all the places where there is existing legislation, and even we're trying to come up, we have come up with language on a new piece of trade women's legislation that we're trying to sell, that Hillary Clinton is helping us put together.
Which is?
Just about educating Congress, I guess, on the status of tradeswomen and advocating for more funding for the training of women to enter the trades. It's pretty early stages. But we have a Senate resolution, number SR-103, I believe, that has to do with, or maybe it's 163, that has to do with, it's a resolution honoring tradeswomen that Hillary Clinton and others sponsored. Mm-hmm. So the issue is bubbling to the fore, and we're really pushing it there. We've got also contacts with the Building and Construction Trades Department of the AFL-CIO and support from them on a number of things. We had with them, we hosted a leadership summit for women in the trades back in January, I believe, and it was attended by labor leaders and tradeswomen's leaders, and that was pretty productive. And what's in the works is a committee in the AFL-CIO, Building and Construction Trades Department, for the Committee on Women.
After all these years.
After all these years.
Yeah. But
so it's
major.
It's bites. Bites and steps, and getting these good faith agreements, mm-hmm. and these handshakes. That's the fight. Mm-hmm. The struggle is not going to be over. And plus, you also have to figure that these policies are going to have to trickle down to the local level. So it may be years before we really see the fruits of this, but it's very encouraging that we're making headway.
It seems that with the struggle to get Congress to pay attention to the requirements, the real needs of women in terms of training, in renewing TANF, or actually trying to renew it, mm-hmm. It seems like a very frustrating kind of effort to get them to understand or incorporate with the Republican mentality, the kind of anti-labor mentality.
Yeah, and it's also frustrating.
Traditional ways of thinking about women's role.
Yeah, and it's also frustrating that there are congressional acts that they're trying to overturn, like Title IX is threatened, mm-hmm. and it's just you'd think that we'd be moving onward instead of moving backwards, okay. and then forwards again. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's the nature of social change. So just have to keep plugging at it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I wanted to talk to you a bit about you moved in a new direction recently.
I did.
And so describe that.
Well, let's see. I guess it was around last summer, working at New, one of my roles as the WANTA coordinator was to help unions and employers with their recruitment practices. And there was actually a very specific recruitment effort that I guess we were trying to make into a model. And we secured an agreement from the elevator mechanics apprenticeship program. It's part of the IBEW, mm-hmm. Local 3.
What is that logo? Is just a, it's a light bulb.
Yeah, it's a light, right. It's a hand in kind of the shape of a light bulb with light rays coming out. It's the logo of the IBEW.
Electrical
3.
Division.
I guess it's the IBEW's uh-huh. logo. And it's the elevator division of Local 3. They were recruiting. They recruit every 3 years or so. Their contract goes for 3 years, and the contract stipulates how many apprentices they can take in. So they actually worked closely with us and opened up their recruitment procedures to us so that we could... And this all had to be approved by the mm-hmm. State Department of Labor, but
and
why wouldn't it be?
New.
New, yes. Okay. And, why wouldn't the State Department of Labor approve these things? That was one of the stumbling blocks that I ran into at New, trying to advocate for extra measures to be taken in recruitment. A lot of times the apprentice directors would say, but the Department of Labor has to approve everything. But, mm-hmm. they have to approve it because you can demonstrate that you have a lack of female mm-hmm. applicants, and so in this case the Department of Labor had approved that the application filing fee and the testing fee or whatever mm-hmm. could be waived, and that the applications wouldn't have to be sent in individually by the women, but we could actually process them and help the apprenticeship by processing them, making sure they were complete, and then send them to the apprenticeship. So we were able to actually collect, I believe, 120 completed applications out of thousands and thousands of requests for information. And out of that 120, only 15 or so, I think, actually finished and went to the testing and the interview. And out of those, I think 7 passed the test and 4 were admitted after the interview, like either
and
showed
the
up.
Test,
So how did I get there? Well, so I was running this whole recruitment process, right. And at some point, even sort of just as a test to see if my name would make it through, mm-hmm. I went ahead and applied for this as well. I requested mm-hmm. an application. And I guess the way I was thinking about it, you know, as I told you, I don't often plan too far in the future. Mm-hmm. I guess I just wanted to keep that opportunity open. There was something in the back of my head saying, you know, WANTU funding might be running out, and you know, maybe this would be a good trade for me. And I knew it would be a good trade for me because 2 of my best mentors are elevator constructors in the International Union of Elevator Constructors.
Lauren Sugarman
and Connie Ashbrook.
Okay.
So getting feedback from them, they knew that I would be happy in this trade, mm-hmm. and probably more happy, even though I really have most experience in carpentry, probably more happy than working as a commercial carpenter hanging sheetrock.
You know, now, why is that? Explain to me.
And the reason for that is that in my trade, although there are many very manual aspects to it, and actually very menial as well, there is a troubleshooting function that the best mechanics are good at. And again, going back to our discussion about technology and the changing nature of it, some of the 30-year mechanics are having trouble with the new computerized controllers mm-hmm. because it's not what they're used to. And, you know, I can kind of appreciate the pros and cons of computerized versus mechanical. Mm-hmm. The mechanical controller is the old giant, you know, it's kind of like a mainframe mm-hmm. is to a small computer. It's a giant controller with a lot of electrical contacts clicking in and out. And you can actually see the movement of the contacts, so you can actually imagine the current flowing, you know, when they close and not flowing when they open. And the new computerized ones, all that's done in circuitry. So when there's something wrong on the old ones, you might be able to see something fell off, you know, physically fell off. And the new ones, you have to use other techniques of diagnosing what went wrong. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a good trade for me because I think I'm really good at synthesizing that much information and drawing conclusions about different technologies and being introduced to new ones. I don't feel threatened or nervous about that. Whereas a lot of the older mechanics are having more trouble with that. But at any rate, when I was pretty sure that it would be a good trade for me, I knew my funding was going to run out. So it was either stay and fight for more funding mm-hmm. Or actually switch to the other side and advocate for women from the inside. And it was actually an experience that I had with TNT going to Washington and meeting, you know, very important legislators and meeting with the head of, I guess it's the Secretary Vice President of the Building and Construction Trades Department. And around the table, the other activists that I'm working with are saying, hi, I'm Lauren Sugarman, elevator constructor. Mm-hmm. You know, hi, mm-hmm. I'm Beth Yone, operating mm-hmm. engineer. And then I would introduce myself as Margarita Suarez from Non-Traditional Employment for Women. And already, that's placing myself outside this conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm an outsider. So I thought, you know, why don't I see what it's like to be on the inside? I'll get some firsthand experience. I'll enjoy it, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll build some credentials for future work. So I still am working on TNT. I'm still on the board of TNT, mm-hmm. but it's not in the same capacity. I was the secretary of that organization before, and now I've resigned so that I can, you know, concentrate on my apprenticeship. Mm-hmm. And it's true, I really have a lot less time for typing memos mm-hmm. and letters and putting
thinking
together
about
packets.
It. But I see, I printed out the schedule for 2005 for mm-hmm. TNT.
Great.
And have an ambitious program.
Yes.
And it's all over the country.
All over the country.
Exciting things happening.
Yes.
So will you be able to participate in some of that?
Well, I will. There's a board meeting coming up in March. Mm-hmm.
And that will
thankfully
be in New York
City. In New York City. Because we were trying to decide whether to have one, and I didn't realize that my hesitation was because I didn't think I could travel again. Mm-hmm. And we hadn't been to New York in a long time, and we were planning to go to the West Coast in June or May. So it made sense to come to the East Coast. We've been meeting in Chicago, you know. Mm-hmm. So that makes it easy for me to attend. And yes, I will try to get time off to go to the annual meeting in Sacramento, and maybe even attend that conference, the tradeswoman's conference.
So tell me about your experiences in your apprenticeship. First of all, how many classroom hours and how many years and all those basics?
Oh, the classroom hours. I don't know the number offhand, okay. But we have to have 18 sessions every semester. There's eight mm-hmm. semesters, and the session is 4 hours.
And so where do you attend school?
And I attend school at Park West High School, which actually has a vocational and elevator program for the high school students mm-hmm. in that school. And I hear that it's threatened, but it's really cool because the kids who go through that elevator program get to come in as second year apprentices.
Is that in the Bronx?
No, it's that? Here on 50th and 10th.
Oh, okay.
It's in Midtown. And so I attend once a week for 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I've already studied Intro to Elevator Systems, where we studied all the parts of an elevator and how they work and how the safety mechanisms work, different types of elevators, overhead traction and basement traction and geared and gearless, and all the different types, the anatomy of elevators pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And then this semester I'm just finishing Intro to Electric Theory.
And how are you finding the work? In the classroom.
In the classroom?
It's accessible? I mean,
it is accessible,
uh-huh.
Yes. In fact, I could see that if I stuck with this trade and moved up, you know, I would have some ideas for improving the curriculum even.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always tough because really I'd say 85 to 90% of the learning that I'm doing is on the job.
Mm-hmm.
But there is really valuable stuff like safety things. We have a couple safety classes every semester, and just learning the names for things in a structured way. I mean, people learn in different ways. I'm really good at classroom learning,
mm-hmm.
so of course I have all these ideas of making the classroom learning a lot tighter, but a lot of the learning is really done outside the classroom as
right.
well.
Now, how do you find the instructor or instructors so far?
Mixed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think different instructors bring different enthusiasm, different skills. You know, mm-hmm. I've had both kinds, actually. But I have to say, even the act of showing up at school and seeing your classmates and then talking to your teacher who works in the industry, even if it has nothing to do with the textbook, that's really valuable.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I really find it valuable to go to school.
Tell me about the other females in the program. How many are?
Well, I know of at least one female mechanic out there, and in the other union, the Elevator Constructors Union, mm-hmm. I think there's a handful as well.
Is that Local 1?
Local 1 of the Elevator Constructors mm-hmm. Union. And this is Local 3 Elevator Division.
And you do the same work?
We don't exactly do the same work,
mm-hmm.
although there are, I'm in the maintenance department, so there's installation, maintenance, repair, and modernization. We don't do installation. So if it's a new building that doesn't have an elevator,
mm-hmm.
or if it's an old building that never had an elevator, that's Local 1's jurisdiction.
Okay.
And then we can do maintenance, repair, or modernization. So as long as we're not laying new rails, we can totally tear out an elevator and put a new one in.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be modernization. Repair is the big machines and big parts. That some generators and hoist motors that have to be yanked out and pulled to the shop. And I'm in maintenance, so that means cleaning, oiling, lubricating, maintaining, but also troubleshooting.
Okay, are you gonna have a chance to learn the full range of skills that the people in your local do during your apprenticeship?
Theoretically, you can. And you can do it through a number of ways. You can do it through the official way, which is in the union book, which says each apprentice shall have the opportunity to try maintenance, which I think implies that for the most part it's hard to get into maintenance.
Okay.
That they would, you know, you could be doing repair or modernization
mm-hmm.
for your entire career if it didn't have that clause that said mm-hmm. you should be given the chance to try maintenance. Maintenance mechanics don't get laid off as much as mm-hmm. modernization crews, because modernization crews go in, do a project, you know, modernize these three elevators,
mm-hmm.
and then if there's no work right after that, they get laid off.
Mm-hmm.
So they get paid a tiny bit more per hour. But maintenance people tend to work year-round, and with all the overtime and everything, and the, I guess, the promotion structure, you can actually end up making more money through maintenance. So I think that's why that clause is in there. Now, from my point of view, I'm sure they put me in maintenance because of my educational background. And I think a lot of other women and smaller men are put into maintenance because, some of the other trades are just really heavy. And it's not that I don't think I could do it, but I don't know if I personally would be interested in lifting and heaving and hoisting all day. And, you know, that would be fun for somebody else, mm-hmm. but I don't think that would be the best use of my skills. So that being said, at the facility where I'm working now, there are modernization crews working and mm-hmm. repair crews that come in. And when the repair crews come in, I often have to show them where they're going, and then I end up staying with them and helping them or mm-hmm. watching them. And same with the modernization crews. Sometimes I get to put a screwdriver in there, but a lot of times I'm just observing what they're doing. And I'm sure if I really asked, you know, can I spend 3 days in mod, I think that would be possible. So now for other students that I've met, other apprentices, I've heard them complaining, you know, they don't put me in, you know, I want to go try maintenance, but I'm this big guy and they think that I'm only good for repair. So, you know, it's a struggle for the guys as well.
Right.
You know, maybe for the women, it's a struggle just to be taken seriously as far as physical abilities mm-hmm. go.
Now, tell me about the work experience. How many years is this program? Okay, so this is tape 2 on December 26, 2004, interviewing Margarita Suarez. Margarita, you're telling me about the apprentice program, the length. And
yeah, it's 4 years. You have to attend 8 semesters. Mm-hmm. And only after that are you eligible to get a journey card. But to be promoted to journey person, it's at the discretion of your employer. So these are things that probably mm-hmm. could be improved in the next contract. Mm-hmm. Although in practice, employers, at least the employers that I'm familiar with, tend to want to accelerate you to mechanic status because they need people to cover routes. Mm-hmm. So yeah, four years at school, but I guess the union contract provides the minimum scale for what you should be making.
And so do you work for one contractor, or does the union find you the job? How does that work?
So when you finish the application process, you get a letter from the union saying, come down and get a referral. Once you've been accepted, they say, okay, you've been accepted, come down and pick up your referral. And you go down there and they have a computer system, and the referrals are handed out in the order that they arrived at the union. And if more than one person was requested, they're split up so that one, you know, if one company can take 20 employees, they don't take the top 20 people. And you're assigned in order of rank. So you go down there, you get your referral paper, and then you go to the place where you're supposed to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to give you a job. Now, I don't know what conclusions I should draw, and I didn't make an issue of it at the time, but my first referral I turned down because I needed time to finish up what I was doing at New, mm-hmm. finish my work, my reports and everything. The second referral I got, they didn't give me work. And so I went back to the Joint Employment Office, and they said, you know, that wasn't supposed to happen. So, you know, I guess I could have made an issue mm-hmm. of it, but, you know, who wants to work for an employer that doesn't want you?
Right.
Right. So they gave me another referral right away, mm-hmm. and that's where I am now. There's about 40, I believe. Could be 20. I think there's 40 employers in my union.
Okay. And this employer, who is this employer?
It's Nouveau Elevator Industries, mm-hmm. and or Nouveau. A lot of the guys say Nouveau, so uh-huh. that's how I say it too. But
it's like a French.
It's like the
Nouveau.
French word for
yeah.
new,
mm-hmm.
and it's a family business. It's the largest privately held company in Local 3 Elevator Division. Mm-hmm. So it's not you know, Otis, which is Unitech. It's not Mainco, which does Macy's. You know, it's not. I think those companies are either smaller and or public stock companies. It's a family business. It's run by the father, the mother, and 4 sons.
Oh.
And it's, you know, it's pretty quirky, but I'm enjoying working there mm-hmm. for the most part.
And how, do you work with a journeyman, or how
I
does
do.
That work?
Well, what happens in, especially in maintenance, a little bit different in modernization, I think, because I think you have pairs of mechanic helper, mechanic helper, mechanic mm-hmm. helper, and then you'll have a mod team of 8 people, which is 4 mechanics and 4 helpers, and then they go to do the work on fixing, you know, changing 4 elevators. But in maintenance, there's, I think, 40 or 50 mechanics who cover Manhattan, let's say, in my division, and there's maybe 4 or 5 helpers. So the helpers tend to rove around right. and help whoever needs help. Mm-hmm. Now, needing help might mean paint that, clean that, mm-hmm. but it also might mean run the car while I do something to the controller, mm-hmm. or it also might mean help me hold this big, heavy thing. And so I started out, my first day on the job was running parts. So I got to get familiar with some of the jobs around the city and meet some of the mechanics by handing them a part. Mm-hmm. And probably by the first complete week that I was on the job, I started on Thursday, so by the Monday, they had me sitting with a mechanic in a resident situation. And I didn't know it at the time, but afterwards he told me that it was my test, that the boss had said, take this girl helper, and mm-hmm. we're called girl helpers, mm-hmm. And see what she's made of, see if we're going to keep her or not. Mm-hmm. And he said that I passed the test, that they're going to keep me. So that was kind of nice in hindsight to see that that was a test, and I didn't mm-hmm. even know it was, so right. I wasn't nervous, and yeah. I was just being myself.
Yeah.
So
wonderful.
So that boded well. And currently, and I spent another couple of days running around, and then I ended up at another resident situation. Resident means it's a big building that has a number of elevators, and they mm-hmm. want a mechanic on site at all times, and sometimes also a helper. Mm-hmm. So I went to another resident job, and these were both in Midtown, big corporate buildings. Mm-hmm. And I was there for about a month and a half, and that's where I sort of learned how to operate a certain type of equipment and maintain this other type of equipment. And I also had a little experience working on changing light bulbs and things like that, which, you know, seems like it would be pretty simple, but sometimes it's the circuitry that's broken and mm-hmm. the holder that's broken or whatever. So I did that for a month and a half, and then I bounced around a little bit more, and then I landed, they placed me in a resident job that opened up at NYU Medical Center. It's on 30th Street and 1st Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I have 2 mechanics there that the university pays for, or I guess the medical center pays for 2 mechanics and a helper at all times, mm-hmm. Monday through Friday, and a mechanic, 1 mechanic on Saturday. And so I've been there since March or April, I believe, and I'll be completing my first year January 22nd. So the big thing that just happened yesterday, I covered the hospital by myself, and I actually worked on 3 elevators and, you know, didn't break anything, didn't hurt myself, didn't hurt anybody else, and so, you know, it feels kind of good. I'll get paid for B mechanic, that's junior mechanic, mm-hmm. for a day, overtime, mm-hmm. and
how much about is that rate? I mean,
That rate is, I think it's about $40 an hour with the overtime.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about, like, we're in the electricians union. Electricians, construction electricians, make a lot more than us per hour. I think mm-hmm. the top mechanic rate is like $35 an hour, $33 an hour, but we don't ever get laid off. Mm-hmm. So that's the explanation. It's a maintenance mm-hmm. trade, not a construction trade. But yeah, my mechanic was joking with me a lot mm-hmm. about how this is more money than I pretty much make in a week. It's not really true, but
yeah.
but it's uh-huh. It's close.
So how do you find the reaction of the men to you?
It's interesting.
When you show up on the job.
Well, what I, unbeknownst to me, mm-hmm. before I even showed up, my boss had put out the word that if anyone screwed up in front of me, there would be hell to pay. And actually, when
meaning
I went,
what?
Meaning, take the porn down, be nice to her, you know, I don't want to hear any bullshit kind of thing. And actually, when I went in to sign up for the job, I had to fill out paperwork, then I had to go get my picture taken for my ID, then I had to pick up my uniforms, I had to get my safety bag and have a lecture from the safety director about what everything in the bag was for, which, you know, is a nice thing that we have a safety program mm-hmm. and a safety class at my job, but you also have to keep in mind that one's own safety is one's own responsibility, mm-hmm. because the boss is not going to support you if you hurt yourself. They're going to say you didn't put that on, or why did you touch that, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing was to talk to my boss, my future supervisor. And so he took me into a room, closed the door, lit up a cigarette, which is something that you kind of have to get used to, yeah. in this trade. Again, they say choose your own battles, and, you know, I guess I've chosen to put up with the passive smoke rather than mm-hmm. to make an issue of it at this point. But he just said, look, I'll talk to you frankly. You're the first woman I've ever had in my department, the first woman ever in this department. And I'm not really sure some of the guys are going to be good, and I don't know about the rest of them. Mm-hmm. So if anything should happen whatsoever, this is my cell phone number. I want you to call me right away. So I took that as a good faith mm-hmm. effort for him to support yeah. my success. And he also said that he would like to say, when he retires, that he had a couple women mechanics under nice. Him. So that felt really good, especially mm-hmm. after being turned down for that first job and mm-hmm. wondering what the real mm-hmm. reason was. He said, oh, it's an error. We didn't really want apprentices. And then, of course, other people ended up working there. So
he really is nouveau.
Yeah, it was nouveau. So here I am starting out, and, you know, I had a little, nobody was really overtly not nice to me. And, in fact, I think I'd say I only know one mechanic who doesn't really like me, that I know doesn't really like me. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't like anybody, oh, you know. Yeah. And he's very difficult to work with, but, you know, from everyone's point of view. Mm-hmm. But I remember my current mechanic that I'm working with, who's actually going to be leaving in the beginning of the year, and I'll have another mechanic moving in. So that's always, you got to get used to change again. Mm-hmm. But he's a really smart guy, and kind of nerdy and kind of quirky, mm-hmm. but I like it, you know, and I get along with, he's kind of got a very obsessive personality. So when he's talking about something to you, he'll just talk to you about it and talk to you about it and talk to you about it.
Give you a lot of information.
Give you a lot of information, ask you a lot of questions about it, even if it's clear that you don't really want to talk about it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's right out there. I like him a lot. And after the first day, his name's Kevin. Mm-hmm. After the first day, Kevin said to me, so, you know, when they told me that you were going to come down here, I didn't really know what to think. I was a little bit nervous, a little bit anxious. I didn't know what was going to happen. But we're doing okay, right? It's okay, right? It's working out, right? Mm-hmm. And it was really earnest and really sweet of him to even admit to me that he was feeling anxious. Yeah. You know, it just felt really nice and close, you know? Mm-hmm. And, familiar or something. And so I had a pretty good idea that it would work out well. And my other mechanic, Scott, I think he was a lot more nervous about me to begin with, because mm-hmm. now that I know his personality a little better, he tends to assume the worst before, you know, kind of calming down about something. Yeah. So I think he was probably thinking, oh, they're sticking the girl helper here. I don't know what that's going to mean. You know, more work for me. Mm-hmm. But I've been pulling my weight and learning, and I think they've been happy with how I've been doing. You know, they'll actually openly say in front of me, which I think is funny, you know, that other helper, he's lazy and a waste of time, you know. When he comes here, we're actually counterproductive, kind of thing. So even though they haven't said, we like you, you're a good helper, mm-hmm. they'll say, we don't want him, he's not a good helper. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I take that as positive, positive feedback. Mm-hmm. And these guys are young, they're in their early 30s, but they've been in the field for 15 and 10 years respectively, mm-hmm. and they know a lot about the field, but they're also young enough to imagine a girl doing this, mm-hmm. even though they've never seen one before. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I've never had a girl working with me before. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was going to be like, but mm-hmm. you know, it's okay, right? It's all right, right? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, now and then we get into these conversations where with them or with other mechanics where, and maybe it's partially true, I don't know, I don't like to think so, but someone will sort of say, well, I think the only reason why they put you here in this resident job, which is a mint placement, like you really want a resident job because you can put your stuff there. I mean, I play softball in the summer and I have to carry my gear around. Can mm-hmm. you imagine if I was bouncing around all of Manhattan, right. trying, where would I put my gear? How would I get to my game by 6 o'clock, you know? it's just nice, and you work with the same elevators all the time. You're not bouncing around, so you can sort of get to know their personalities and see their recurring problems instead of being hit with something new every few months. Anyway, it's a mint placement, but the perception is that I was put there so they could hide me from the guys. You know.
Yeah. Because, so you wouldn't be circulating all through Manhattan, or?
Yeah, so I wouldn't encounter any trouble, because if they put me with two decent guys at one place and kind of tuck me away in a mm-hmm. corner, I can't say this guy said that to me mm-hmm. or put that up on the wall mm-hmm. or, you know, did this to me, you know. And in a way, yeah, maybe it is nice to have to avoid that. On the other hand, then the next conclusion that some of the guys draw is it's because I'm not as capable or something like that. Or maybe that's what I'm reading into it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that I deserved this mint placement right. from being interested, on time, you know, proactive and, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. It's because I'm a girl.
Right. And they say that, I mean, that's a continuing theme, women in
well,
the tradition.
Yeah, I guess mm-hmm. it's, it comes up every now and then. Like, mm-hmm. I realize that some guys think it, and maybe that's just the way that they choose to understand it. You know, they assume, oh, it must be because of that. But then on the other hand, we just had our holiday party, and I met a lot of the mechanics that I had worked with just once or twice mm-hmm. in the beginning before I got put on the resident jobs. And others that I know from talking to on the phone.
You say the holiday party, was it for the union or the company?
Just for the informal party among the mechanics okay. and helpers. Mm-hmm. And I'd say maybe 30 of them were there. At least maybe half of them were there. And a lot of them, at least, you know, to my face anyway, they're very friendly and supportive. Mm-hmm. And it seems like they do want me to succeed. It's like I'm the novelty.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really know what to expect going in, and I was entering a culture where no girls had ever gone before, mm-hmm. and maybe, yeah, tucked away in this resident job, I'm not a threat to anyone because they haven't had to work with me and feel that their job was threatened by
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think they do, a lot of them do like me, you know, as a person, or I like them, so.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is it working in this blue-collar environment? Like you said, it's not construction, but still, it's
definitely blue collar. Mm-hmm. We wear uniforms that look like, you know, repair person uniforms.
Mm-hmm.
It's a gray set of Dickies, and every now and then it hits me, you know, because of course my mom, who's learned to just kind of roll with my changing careers and whims, mm-hmm. instead of saying, "Don't you think you should have gone to medical school?" And they never really pressured me like that, but they were a little bit wondering, like, oh, you're going to Nicaragua to build houses, like, what about your career? Like, you can always go back to computers, right? And I think they realize that the money is not what's important to me, and that I'm doing well for myself, mm-hmm. and that I'm happy, you know? So my mom will say stuff like, well, is your education going to waste, and that kind of thing. So I think about that kind of thing every now and then, but, and then once in a while at the hospital where I work, let's say I'll be walking down the hall and someone's approaching me and they'll say, "Hi, good morning, how are you?" And I'll kind of answer, but they're talking to the person right behind me
mm-hmm.
and just totally ignoring
mm-hmm. yeah.
the fact that I'm there. And it's mm-hmm. because in this uniform, I'm visible to others in uniform. Hey, how's it going? Mm-hmm. What's going on, man? You know, have a good holiday?
Mm-hmm.
But to the ones in the doctors and the nurses' uniforms and the med student mm-hmm. uniforms.
Background.
Just background, mm-hmm. part of the furniture,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested, as a member of Local 3, you have to attend apprenticeship meetings, or you're in the certain division.
We're in the division, so we have division helper meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're once every 2 months, except in the summer, so I think there's 5 or 6 meetings per year. And it's really good to go to those meetings. Not everybody does,
mm-hmm.
and we just had a big pep talk by Chris Erickson, who's, I believe, the business agent of our division. He handles also the other kind of maintenance divisions and odd divisions of the Local 3, like the people who work at the Javits Center, you know, and that kind of thing. People work for the MTA, I think. And he was just saying, you know, everyone promised to bring another person. You gotta show up, because in our industry, it seems to be very employer heavy. You know, it's a joint the joint industry board mm-hmm. is supposed to balance the interests of the union and the employers. But in the kind of work that we do, for some reason, it seems really easy to kind of cave into the employers, because the employers offer us more money. I mean, the union scale is a recommendation of the minimum pay. So what will happen is the employers will offer more money, and all of a sudden you're sort of beholden to them. And so if someone's doing your brother wrong, well, I'm going to lose my expense. Mm-hmm. They don't actually up your salary, because that would be official, and they'd have to pay payroll taxes mm-hmm. and put in a percentage for your pension. They pay you car expenses. So some guys are getting hundreds of dollars a week, mm-hmm. excuse me, in car expenses. And the employers hold that over them as a way to make them not want to speak up.
How do you experience the union meetings and the level of support of the union towards you?
Excuse me, I'm just going to get some water.
Okay. So when you attend union meetings, what kind of response do you get from the brothers?
It's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd say there's a handful, 10 people that will be very friendly and shake my hand, and then there's some that I don't really greet, or they don't greet me. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's the nature of attending any meeting. And the shop steward of my company is actually the chairman of the elevator division. So he knows me. And the interesting thing is that before they knew that I had quit New, the Office of Apprenticeship Training and Employer Labor Services, OATELS, with whom I had done some work at New, it was a pilot initiative to offer technical assistance to employers and unions that was actually kind of successful because the climate had changed and the employers and unions were actually seeking it. Mm-hmm. One of the women who works with OATELS from Boston, I believe, she contacted me and said, would you like to speak about recruitment practices of women at the Eastern States Apprenticeship Conference, so ESAC conference mm-hmm. up in, it was in Maine.
It's from the Department of Labor?
State Department of Labor, mm-hmm. yeah. States, I guess all the states of the Eastern mm-hmm. States. And I guess it's the states. It might be the national thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a big official apprenticeship conference, and all the apprenticeship directors go there, and I know a bunch of apprenticeship directors because of my work at New.
Right.
Painters, the laborers, elevator division. So I wrote back, and I said, I'd love to come and talk at your conference, but, I've left New, and I'm working as an apprentice now, and I'll see if I can get the time off. She said, well, it would be lovely if you could come and talk mm-hmm. about the recruitment for the elevator project and your work at New, and you talk about TNT. So I actually arranged to get the time off with my boss, got a ride with the apprentice director of the Painter Union, and who's a friend of mine, and we drove up to Portland. And when I went to register, the first person that I saw was my shop steward, who is the chairman of my division. And he didn't know I was going there. I didn't assume that he was going. I just totally forgot that there would be people from my division is 1,600 people mm-hmm. out of this 33,000 in Local 3. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't really thinking that mm-hmm. we would be there in such force. There were about 5 people from the elevator division there. So he said, what are you doing here? I said, oh, I'm speaking. He's like, oh, okay. And I ended up meeting the business representative, Rob Olenek, and there was the guy who works on the apprenticeships. He's like the apprentice school coordinator, and the apprentice director was there, Nick LaGuardia. And is that all from my union? Yeah, and then others from Local 3, mm-hmm. Chris Erickson, who's the business agent, was there, but I didn't get to meet him. And they actually attended my talk. That was really nerve-wracking
uh-huh.
because, I'm supposed to be this peon,
right.
and then I'm giving a talk at this conference that they're paying to attend.
Yeah.
So that was interesting, and it was nerve-wracking, and there's always a little bit of distance that they put between me and them, maybe because they're shy, maybe because I'm a woman, maybe because I'm a woman who spoke at ESAC, who worked on the apprenticeship program, you know, maybe if they see women as a threat, as like a sexual harassment threat, I'm the biggest type there can be because I come from the agency that would, in their eyes, you know, get them in trouble for that. So after I gave my talk, I was kind of hanging around with some of my friends from the other apprenticeships and some people from New. And then they came out to smoke, and they were kind of standing nearby and kind of shuffling around. So I kind of shuffled a little bit nearer. And then my shop steward, his name is Joe Licata, just came up to me. He didn't say, great talk, or I hated your talk, or, you know, how's it going? He just said, do you have a lapel pin? And I said, no, I don't. And he said, here, take one. You need one of these. And it's an elevator division, IBEW Local 3 lapel pin. And so I took that as the sign that I did good. You know, and then, of course, they went out and did their drinking on their own, and I'm sure they were talking about me or whatever, but, you know, whatever they were talking about. But, you know, so we didn't really socialize a lot, but that gesture of handing me a pin, I think, was like, okay, you can kind of be one of us because we're the delegates who go to the conferences kind of thing.
Well, I have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you about your ideas on recruitment strategy, but maybe before we go there, we'll just conclude with, I mean, even though you say that you don't plan ahead, but when you think about your future, do you have some dreams or goals that you think in this field? And you think about that first, and then we'll talk about advocacy.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I know the things that I've been good at in the past and things that I can imagine that I would be good at. And there's the things that really scare me, but that I could probably do, that somebody needs to do. And I guess if I were to guess at what I would do with all of this and where I would be going, is that I would like to continue advocacy in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, advocacy involves talking to people that you don't know, which is always very stress-inducing for many people, including myself. And it means being well-spoken, and a lot of times it's easy to get tongue-tied or not have your thoughts collected in a way to present to people in an understandable way. And it also involves mingling in an environment that doesn't necessarily inspire a lot of comfort for me. So, for example, when I took the job at New, coming from the casual environment at Columbia and also being a construction worker in Nicaragua, and then going to New, where I was going to be, you know, giving speeches in Washington, D.C., and, you know, talking to apprentice directors and this and that, it's a whole other culture to enter. And, you know, especially, you know, not being a typically feminine woman, not knowing where I would fit into that culture. And I remember Martha Baker, who is the woman who hired me, the former executive director of New. She must have had questions too, because she was like, you know, do you think you can do this? You think you can talk to apprentice directors? This was after we attended a meeting in D.C. about the grant, and I had just started. It was my first day of work. We went down to the grantees meeting, and I said, yeah, I think I can do it. She's like, you're going to have to get a suit, you know, and I, that was really mind-blowing for me, because it was just like, I'm going where I don't really necessarily want to hang out, you know, but maybe it's somewhere necessary for someone to go. And so, you know, I'm just sort of finding my way. So even though I can't really imagine what it would be like to do this function, I think that's probably where I would be heading, because I think, you know, I think that when I'm prepared enough or feeling confident enough, I can be pretty convincing. And I think I feel pretty convicted about these issues. And
just for the record, you inspire confidence in others.
Really?
You always have in me.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I mean, I mostly feel confident, like, about myself. But when it turns to having to interact with other people, you know, of course you don't want to feel rejected or, you know, not included or whatever. But I guess, what were we talking about? Like, where
your dreams,
where this would go?
Goals, and how you can use all that you bring to this, where you see yourself. doing what you see yourself doing?
Oh, yeah. So, like, in the present time, I can see that it's already starting to happen, that I'm a confident person. I know I can do this trade. It might be different from a woman who entered who didn't know if she could do this trade. And so then the guys who I work with, they know I can do this trade because I have that confidence and that ability. So even changing minds on a very personal level starting now, you know, in the future maybe they'll be changing minds on a national level with policies. But at the moment I'm putting in my time doing it on a personal level. And I'm finding out really interesting things, like I wonder how you get the grease stains from the dirty, greasy machines out of your work pants. And you know, not a single mechanic that I've asked has been able to tell me, because he doesn't do the laundry.
Have to do. Yep.
Not only does he not do the laundry, but he doesn't care about the laundry. And then I found out the other day that both my mechanics have never made a grilled cheese sandwich and didn't even know how they would go about it.
Interesting.
And I said, grilled cheese is the easiest thing you can make. Well, how long do you have to cook it on the side? I don't know how I would do that. Which tells me that they've never, ever cooked. Not even like macaroni and cheese or something like that from a box, you know? And these are guys who can fix a very complicated elevator.
Different lifestyle.
Very different lifestyle. Very different.
So now, we want to talk a bit about you have this background in technology and now in the trades. And when you look at a field like electronics, where women, you know, you don't have to lift heavy things. You don't, it's in the head. I mean, it's, but what is it that's keeping women out of this field? What are the things that could change to draw women in? I mean, you did talk about, you know, you have to get to girls when they're younger so they can play and see if it fits. But what would change this? What are some strategies?
I think the big thing is for women to have the experiences that would instill confidence in them. So, you know, if you hand someone a hammer and a nail and they've never, ever, ever done it in their lives, are they going to be confident about their ability to do it? Because it takes some learning curve, some practice finessing it, you know.
Even they talk about the differences in females of spatial relations and things like this. And
yeah,
I mean, girls. So we were talking about
girls don't get blocks. Yeah, and I think the problem is that a lot of people would like to say that girls don't get blocks because they don't want blocks, or they don't need blocks, or they can't do blocks. There's something inherently biologically different about girls that makes them bad at blocks, so you might as well not give them blocks. And, you know, I had to do a lot of thinking about these kinds of issues when I was studying for my gender studies degree, or I would have been thinking about it anyway, but that was a nice structured way to do it. And my personal philosophy is that yes, there may be biological differences, just like there's tall people and short people and muscular people and flabby people. But even if there is some genetic disposition toward that, maybe correlated with gender or not, I think the realm of societal influences and those forces is so great that it will overcome the biological forces, if they exist. I don't know if they do. I tend to think that they don't. Maybe they do. Doesn't matter to me. Because people can go to a class and learn how to be a public speaker. And people can go to a class and learn how to lay blocks. And some of them will be better at it than others, and some men will be worse than women, and vice versa. So you were saying, what can we do?
What would be some of the best strategies for change?
Well,
that's
this is
pretty broad question,
it's a broad question. Like, I'm hoping that what I'm doing now is a good strategy. It's not a waste of my time. I mean, of course, I'm enjoying it along the way, so of course it's not a waste of my time. But I think the guys who, even the old, a couple of old timers that I've worked with, who never imagined that a girl would want to do this, much less be able to do this, are seeing that this girl is kind of doing it, you know, and better than some of the guys who come in to do it. So if we could find 10 more women to do what I'm doing, or 20 more women, you know, who would enjoy doing this. Mm-hmm. I think that that would be helpful. It's it's a different strategy than coming in from the outside right. and trying to say, I want to change your attitude about this.
Right. Tell me, since you have developed expertise in recruitment, you have ideas about recruitment, what are the best things? What are the things that work? What are the things we should change?
Well, I think one of the problems with labor unions in the city is that the information is so tightly held. Mm-hmm. You don't even know when you're supposed to apply, much mm-hmm. less how you're supposed to apply or what kind of things you would need. And that's why the elevator recruitment campaign was so different, was because all that information was made open to us so we could try to open it up for mm-hmm. the women. And out of, you know, we submitted hundreds of applications and only got 4 women out of it, but I'd like to say that those 4 women were the ones that they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't have found those 4 women if we hadn't done the campaign. Yeah. Now, others would say, what a waste of time and effort and money. If you only got 4, mm-hmm. it wasn't worth it. But I tend to see things on, not in terms of economics. I mean, economics, of course, you need funding to do stuff. You got to be practical about the amount of money that you're spending. But how do you put a price on what I'm doing or what those other 3 women are doing?
Mm-hmm.
Like, that was only worth $5 to you, $20, $50, $3,000. You know, how do you put a price on the effect that those women are having on their mechanics and the people that they're working with? And I also think that, like we said, sometimes advances, you know, we make advances and then they get taken away and then we make advances again. Does that mean that it wasn't worth making that advance? I don't think so. And some people don't really have a vision like that, so they would get discouraged or think it's not worth it. And it's kind of like the mission of New. A lot of the hubbub and discussions has been, you know, well, if we're not getting placements, then we're failing. And I kind of see it as, of course we want placements. Everybody wants placements. But if we've reached these thousands of women and changed their minds just a little bit about what a woman can do and what they themselves can do, what's going to happen to their nieces or sisters, their daughters, you know. It's kind of like it's a big project to somehow get the word out when it's been assumed all this time that women can't do this or don't want to do it or shouldn't do it. And so, you know, we have to get to the point where women just know that girls just know that they can. Because right now we're in this awkward stage where the women know that they can and they want to, but they've missed 20 years of experience holding a hammer or whatever, you know, that boys have had. So of course they're going to be disadvantaged in the workplace, and then with the sexual harassment and all that on top of it, they're not likely to stay. And so a lot of people might conclude that women weren't suited for it, but I think it's just because we're not at the point where women come in prepared.
Dealing with the apprentice programs, it's interesting that they still... that it's still a mystery, a well-kept secret about the programs, and it doesn't seem to me that the apprentice programs have ever had any funding withheld or been cited for lack of compliance, or
yeah.
It's very easy for them to say, you know, they've made a good faith effort.
Right.
So what are the things that you've learned about working with, what's the holdup there, and what could change and what works?
Well, in my work with New and with TNT, I got to visit and hear about a lot of different programs. In Seattle, now I think their funding got threatened. It's another step back. They have a really great relationship with their State Department of Labor, State Apprenticeship Council. In New York, you know, the head of the Apprenticeship Council was just indicted, I think. You know, so I think there were a lot of stumbling blocks in terms of who was in whose pocket on the local level. But in an ideal world, in Seattle, the Apprentice Council gave money for women and minorities to start jobs. So you had a $7,000 per head, I believe it was, of case management services, tools and uniforms and dues, transportation, whatever you needed to get yourself
child care,
whatever you needed to get yourself going. And then they had a mentorship program, a formal mentorship program, where not only would tradeswomen I guess on their own time, mentor you and support mm-hmm. you. But tradesmen and women in the field would be paid 2 hours per week by the employer to sit down with you and see what the issues are. Mm-hmm. So it's actual put your money where your mouth is. I guess that's the big thing, that when you do put the money towards some of these programs, I think they have a really good effect, instead of just saying, well, the women came in and then they left and we don't know why, and they wouldn't come, they never showed up, you know. And it just seems like the state, I'm still trying to understand bureaucracies, but the federal government, the state governments, there seem to be so many impasses toward making progress. But when you remove some of those impasses, it seems like so much can be done, because it's coming from above. So that's the challenge. Mm-hmm. If you can't make it come from above, maybe you make it come from below at the same time. You work from both directions, from within and from without, or mm-hmm. you know.
It seems that there's a lot of exciting programs that both companies like IBM and Microsoft and government agencies like NASA and universities like Stanford and MIT. I mean, there's all kinds of mentoring programs and support groups, and even I was reading about summer camps for girls to study technology and or math and science mm-hmm. or so there's a lot
starting.
Of stuff out there,
right?
But it's not exactly percolating yet, but it's
right.
The
well, definitely I think the girls of today have it a lot better than I did when I was mm-hmm. a girl. Maybe you did when you were a girl. They have Title IX, which
I think it's big factor.
It's a big factor. They have, because of Title IX, they have Mia Hamm to look up to mm-hmm. and, you know,
right.
whoever, you know, role models. But on the other hand, because of, you know, the gender roles are still being passed down by the parents mm-hmm. or whoever, by the society. So there's a contradiction for these girls. I can do anything, but I got to make grilled cheese for my husband and do the laundry. I have to have a husband, you know. And I think, you know, more and more it is changing, but for the most part, we're still struggling against those mores, I guess. You know, I found a little haven here in New York City where I can disregard a lot of those and feel very comfortable. But mm-hmm. I know when I travel outside of New York City, it's always like a big awakening to be like, oh my goodness, the rest of the country is not like where I've chosen to live.
So traditional.
It's so traditional.
Yeah.
And then you look at those maps, the mm-hmm. election maps, and you're just like, you know, what happened to the middle of the country? Mm-hmm. You know, what mm-hmm. are they doing there? You know, what are they thinking about? What are they doing? So
that's a good note to talk about. Now we are in a period of, it seems, regression in terms of affirmative action, commitment to equality,
mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that it's almost 2005.
Yeah.
So as a young woman, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, aside from what you've already expressed, which is to the point.
Well, I have a little bit of experience in, you know, college activism and did some activism through the 80s and 90s, and you know, I've been around for the rise and fall of many activist organizations and starting of new ones. And what I learned as a young adult in college, just learning, you know, for the first time how to run an organization and plan an event and plan a rally and get the word out about something, is that when times are bad, people will rally. And they'll show up, and they'll complain, and they'll work hard, and then you'll make some progress, and times will be good for a little while. And then people get complacent. And then things get taken away from mm-hmm. them, and then times are bad again. So it's kind of like a cycle, as I see it. And I think probably, you know, civil rights has been that way, feminism has been that way. And I guess my conclusion is that you just have to keep on plugging, you know. You got to have people around who are always working toward that ideal, even in the times when everybody's still happy and not working very hard. And just know that pretty soon it's not going to be so happy, you know, it might not be so happy, and know, people are going to need to have that momentum still there. You know, it would be nice that once you made a social advance, it would stay, mm-hmm. and everybody would buy into it, and then society would advance. But it's not the way it seems to work. So, you know, it's this kind of thing. You know, hardship mm-hmm. is the inspiration for a lot of art and music, poetry. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, as our human predicament is that we need this stuff, or we use it to get somewhere else, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so we just keep on working at it.
Do you write?
No, not really.
Mm-hmm. Do you still consider yourself a pioneer?
I consider myself a pioneer. Well, I didn't really consider myself a pioneer when I entered this field, because I thought, oh, two of my mentors were in this field 25 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, it's women have been going into trades for so many years. And then when I arrived and found out that I was the first one in the company and one of four in the school, it made me feel a little bit like a pioneer. And just, you know, I told my mechanics how to make grilled cheese the other day. So that was kind of pioneering. On the other hand, I really feel the work that was done before me, because I'm in a position, and it maybe has something to do with my trade, that it tends to, the hot shots in my trade are not the brawniest ones, mm-hmm. but the brainiest ones who can fix elevators that no one else can fix. And so maybe they're able to appreciate that in somebody, whether they're a woman or a man, mm-hmm. more than the brawniest person looking at the size of a woman and saying,
she
can't pull her weight. And yeah, she can't pull as much as you, but if you're smart enough, it's like, you know, using a tool.
Mm-hmm. Using a lever.
If you need a 4-foot lever and you only got a 2-foot lever, you work with a 2-foot lever and you don't hurt yourself, and you figure out a way mm-hmm. to get the best advantage out of what you got. Or you use 2 2-foot levers, you know, you use two people. And I think it's harder in the physical realm than it is in the intellectual realm. And like you said, PhD programs are mm-hmm. getting more and more women, and, you know, you see more and more women seeming to make it, you know, in higher office-like settings or government settings mm-hmm. even. Now, it doesn't mean that they're not experiencing hardship or discrimination, but it seems so much more visceral on this level, like so much more obvious that they don't, you know, they'll tell you to your face what they're really thinking in this field. Mm-hmm. They won't mask it. So,
just on a positive note here, in December 2004, a woman is assuming the presidency of MIT for the first time.
Wow.
A woman from the life sciences, but still, no.
Very
so
good.
That's progress.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's happening. Okay.
I think also a woman is the head of RIT.
Really?